The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Tim. How's Tim?
Tim's great today.
Did you thaw out from our sort of nasty week?
Yes, melted.
Yeah, well, we're getting our January thaw, as we call it, much needed, much welcomed. I think it's a good thing.
Yes.
I'm not going to ride my bike.
No.
Well, there's too much of that garbage they put on the streets, that blue stuff.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that is, or even if you stay off the streets, it's still kind of muddy.
And it's icy. It's still icy in spots. So we have a lot of news. Some of it's good, some of it not so, as usual. But the biggest cycling story of the week is Cross Nationals.
Yep.
Yeah. January 13th, Velo News published a commentary by Kaylee Fretz titled "A Nationals Disaster." In it, Fretz says, and I'll quote, "Something fell apart in Austin, Texas over the past weekend. Somehow, somewhere, communication failed. Planning failed. The stewards of the sport of cyclocross in the United States failed. Does failure, however, go hand in hand with fault?" Which is the question. And we have somebody tonight who's going to answer that question. He went on to say, just hours before the final day's racing was to commence in Austin's Zilker Park, the U.S. National Cyclocross Championship was canceled, postponed, and then finally rescheduled for the following afternoon, which was a Monday. Hundreds of racers, families, teams, fans were forced to scramble, change flights, extend hotel stays, and take another day off from work, or they were forced to simply go home, back to their real lives away from the mud. The underpinnings of the failure are complicated. Blame is difficult to extract from the work of Lady Luck and difficult to pin down on any single party, but the foundation is clear. It all started with the trees. And I know, Tim, you're using the term tree hugger.
Well, maybe we should just use the word root hugger.
Root hugger. Well, it does have to do with these heritage trees. But we're going to find out. And here's how we're going to find out. I decided we should get a firsthand analysis and an explanation of not only what happened, but what the consequences of the screw-up might be for the riders and the USA team. Remember, the Worlds are coming up.
Right.
And for the future. I don't believe anyone would have a better perspective on what happened or what should have happened, how it all really turned out in the end, than race promoter and announcer and the newly elected executive director of Mass Bike, Richard Fries. He was there, he can tell us, and he's going to be with us this evening.
Good.
Yes. We're going to take a break, of course, and do some news. And then we're going to head on out to Portland, Oregon. And as promised, because we talked about it last show, Ellie Blue will be with us. Yes, yes. One of the most busy, prolific writers and journalists I know. She's always got a gazillion things going on. She's really interesting, but her old publishing company, the Ellie Blue Press, merged with Microcosm Publishing on January 1st. They've had a close relationship right along, but now what this is going to mean for Ellie, besides taking on a lot of new duties, turns out she's also going to be doing all their marketing, and to the two publishing houses, is our topic this evening. So we'll find out what Ellie's up to. Let's head on over to the offices of Mass Bike, though, and speak with its brand new executive director and our old friend, Richard Fries. Richard, thanks for joining us this evening.
Hi, Diane. Happy New Year.
So, you know, the big news this past week was Cross Nats, and it was a mess. And I know you probably read Velo News' article, but it was actually a commentary called "A Nationals Disaster." Tell us what happened. Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, most of the stuff that's online you can read. A pretty well-connected minority of individuals freak out. And this is, it's not the first time it's happened around cyclocross. People, the aesthetic impact of cyclocross is pretty damaging. The lasting impact of cyclocross can be documented as not having that much damage. But it's their park. They were able to make some radical things happen, even though by everything that I've heard, and I have no reason to doubt, USA Cycling and Cadence Sports, they dotted every T, crossed every I, the permits were issued, there were walkthroughs, they were shown pictures of what cross was, but the Heritage Tree Foundation got involved, and then they were able to make these pretty simple modifications that allowed us to resume racing at noon on Monday. That's the short and long of it. I think that a lot of hardworking, good people and a lot of well-intentioned local residents, everybody, I think, tried to do the best thing. I will say that the behavior of the Austin Police Department was deplorable. Actually bringing tear gas.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, and it was their conduct and their tenor and their tone, especially in light of what we've witnessed this past year.
Really?
And you're talking about, you know, skinny little 15-year-old girls showing up, you know, from all over the country to race their bicycles for something they've trained for, you know, and they're being threatened with arrest. And I'm sure that some hotheads on our side of the equation didn't manage it as well as they could, but I didn't hear that. But it was I arrived. I always ride my bike when I get to these things, and I rode in right on the bike path, so the cops never saw me. So, look, I think Austin was their Convention and Visitors Bureau, their sports council. They did a great thing. I think it all was handled very well. I love the city. I look forward to going back, but the police department really inflamed it unnecessarily. And then, you know, then you have the fallout, flights, hotels, all of that stuff.
Well, and that's sort of the next topic, and that is here you have these juniors, you have these young kids who are, many of them, probably racing their first nationals, and they're faced with, you know, they're out of school to begin with. Now you have families who have to stay an extra day. Now, I know some really good things did come out of it, but you know, they're the future of our sport. Couldn't they have shortened the events? I know that part of the issue was how many riders were in each class and having all those people on the course, that there was no way you were going to combine age groups and or men and women and all of that.
In effect, the way they did that anyhow.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Well, just by virtue of lapped riders. I know that me and my colleague Brad Soner, the other announcer, we were one-armed paper hangers. He was running to awards while I was lining up the next field. We weren't able to start until noon. You know, it gets dark there about 5:15. You also have to factor in that you're trying to do a television production with 60,000 viewers at home. They rushed as hard as they could rush. Dorothy Abbott was the chief official, chief referee in this instance, is what you call it. And, you know, she showed me the schedule, and I said, yeah, I guess so. You have to look at the number of riders you can put on the course. You know, there were some people, even though they were scheduled, you're talking about that junior one that was stacked up, the junior 17-18.
Right.
The 17-18 girls and the 15-16 girls. The largest field was the 15-16 boys, which had up to 80 riders. On the schedule, that one that was tripled up, the 17-18s and the girls, although they said it was scheduled a minute apart, they were starting them within about 30 seconds after. They were starting them right away to get them right on the course, to get them as much racing as possible. You're faced with a massive disparity of talent. This always comes into cyclocross as to how do you manage the timing of the event? How do you figure out how many laps to go? And, you know, some people say you go by the lead rider. Some people say you have to look at the middle rider. So you're dealing with a course that the conditions were such that the fastest, you know, rider was doing lap times 2 to 4 minutes faster than the slowest rider in that group. So undeniably, there was going to be some catches made regardless. When you look at what the lap, what the course times are supposed to be for those age groups, you look what the juniors are doing, and then they had to pass. But you have to look at field numbers. I don't think there was a perfect solution. I concur that you do have to remember that it was a female official that made the decision to stack up the girl categories. But I did take exception with one thing made in comments that was like, yeah, the girls got no attention whatsoever. Well, I can tell you as the announcer, I knew damn well who Emma White was, and I knew damn well who Turner Ramsey was, and I know who the leaders were. The only thing that hurt me was that Turner Ramsey was pulled, meaning she was told to withdraw from the race, and she had done two laps, and she knew that she was the leader, but she thought that there was a clerical mistake, you know what I mean? So that we were unable to celebrate her victory as it was, because it was happening at a time that we're trying to watch two other races. But we had called her out the entire time. She got a lot of, you know, relative to what we were doing, she got a lot of fanfare. You know, U23 wards were rushed so people could make claims. There's more to it than just the map of the racing. People did the best they could, given the circumstances.
Well, it's sad. I'm speaking with Richard Fries. We're talking about the Cross Nationals, which were held in Austin, Texas last weekend. They ran into a disaster with the Heritage Tree Foundation. So in the end, do we have national champions? Do we have a team that's going to be ready to go to the Worlds?
Oh, yeah. In the selection process, cyclocross is always the coolest of elements in the sport. The junior women's categories won't significantly impact our representation of world championships. The junior women don't get to race yet. There is a movement to start a U23 women's cross world championships that's gaining momentum. And I'm a huge advocate for that. Especially when you look at the world championship schedule, there's room in the schedule for it. On the juniors, I think we have the best team, with the exception of, I think, Spencer Petrov. He had a bad mechanical, and he's a great racer, and he had the mechanical early. So the junior team, I think, is the best team. I just think Spencer, if you've looked at his results, that was a tough decision. The women's team is a solid team, and for the elite women, our under 23 men, we got the best under 23 team I think we've seen in a while. And the big difference, the big transition is going to be in the men's race. And that had nothing to do with the course and the selection made there. It was that we're witnessing the transition from Tim Johnson stepping down.
Right.
And Ryan Tremone not, you know, being injured all year. So you have those. So you still have Powers, Page, and Driscoll. You still have that New England triumvirate. And then they added Stephen Hyde, a native of Tallahassee, who's now living in Northampton, Mass., which was really the Cinderella story. Winner at Providence on day two, and winner at Charm City early in the year. He's just been a really good story. And the fifth rider is Zach McDonald, who is one of the most talented, naturally gifted riders. And I will say, in Zach's defense, he has always been accused of not ever really going hard enough or suffering, just relying too much on his natural bike handling skills, which are the best in all of American cross. And that kid turned himself inside out, not only at the Nationals, but in winning a back-to-back UCI weekend at Dallas the weekend before, winning both days of a UCI race. Prior to that, his only UCI victory had been at Providence on day two.
Wow.
So Zach has been through a lot this year. I really like Zach. And I think that he's a young, pressure-packed kid that I think he matured a lot in the last year. I think we have a good team.
You mentioned Tim Johnson, and he did a very magnanimous thing, from what I understand. He was there. He was announcing. He wasn't racing. I know he withdrew. Is it true he put on a dinner for the U23s?
Yeah, all the U23s and juniors that could make it, he picked up the tab for a dinner. He knew that
Jeez.
They had recurring expenses. Tim and I go way back. How do I say this for the public consumption? Tim's mother, he was raised by a single mom. I'm one of the few people that ever met his father before he passed. And Tim grew up without a whole lot. And he, you know, he wasn't poor, but it was a hard scrabble thing for his mother, you know, a town librarian, to get this kid through. So Tim understands the expense of the sport. He also is probably the best career coach one could ever have for the sport. Now, he'd be a fantastic coach, but if people focused a little bit more on managing their careers,
right,
and a little bit less on their heart rates and their wattage and their...
What an interesting comment.
Yeah.
What an interesting comment.
Yeah. I've seen him at the highest points of his career. I've seen him at the lowest points of his career, including when he was in Europe being silently encouraged to dope, and he didn't.
Well, and, you know, we've spoken with him, and he is just, I guess the word I would use is gentleman.
Well, I mean, he's one of these guys that right after every race on Twitter, he congratulates the winners up and down the ranks, and some of the people he is closer with than others, as is customary in sports. And when he wins, they don't return the favor.
Well, and, you know, that's upbringing. So mom did a good job with Tim.
His mom's great.
Yeah. All right, we're going to move on to another subject. I learned this recently. You are now the executive director of Mass Bike. Congratulations.
First day on the job was today.
Yeah. And you know what? Tim told me that you crashed all the computers on your first day.
Yeah, I already crashed the computers. This is like the biggest job I've ever had in my life. It is so unbelievably complicated and diverse and overwhelming at the same time.
Tell us about Mass Bike itself. What is the organization? And then, I mean, we can figure out if you're the executive director, sort of what you're mandated to do, but I want to know what your plans are.
Well, you know, Mass Bike is a bicycle advocacy group that was started initially as the Boston Area Bicycle Coalition. That's what it started as, the BABC. They changed their name to the Mass Bike Coalition after a while. They got started. They're one of the older groups. They started in 1977.
Yeah, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, and Boston being, as they say in Spinal Tap, not much of a college town, they had a pretty vibrant cycling scene even back then. You know, in spreading statewide, they are the mission is to make better bicycling for Massachusetts. Real simple, but, you know, when you figure out how to do that, let me know, because that's my job.
I was just going to say, that's your job. I'm not going to try for you, but if I have any ideas, I will let you know. So what do you mean by making cycling better in Massachusetts? What is it that what kinds of things do you want to accomplish?
Well, this is where I'm still surprised that they hired me. I think like 25 people applied, and they chose me. There was people that probably had better engineering backgrounds, people that had urban planning degrees. And if you look at the official posting for the job, I don't have any of the education that they asked for.
But you have something, obviously, they wanted.
Yeah, go figure. So it was, and I walked right in, you know, in the first interviews. I said, listen, I'm not going to do that. So you're not going to get this from me. You're not going to get that from me. So, and I said, but I am going to do this. This is where I'm going to attack it. And I've actually, my predecessor is a guy named David Watson, who has been exceedingly gracious. And he's been at this for 8 years. He's unbelievably competent. He's a lawyer by trade. He has IT experience. He just, what he has accomplished here is nothing short of brilliant. And yet it was very much down in the trenches stuff.
Why did he step down?
Yeah, I think David would even admit we're actually going to hire him as our lobbyist and as our consultant.
Oh, I see. Okay, so he's going to switch roles and go back to having a life. Because this sounds like a full-time job as in 24/7.
It's huge. And it's meeting after meeting, unbelievable politics, then the HR and the administration of it, and then the development. And David will be the first to tell you he's not a development guy, a fundraiser. My attitude is that we've done a great job in the Boston area getting started. We have a long way to go, but I think the common thread in advocacy is that we need legislation and engineering. And to that, I agree. But I believe that we are, people think that we're going to engineer this perfect environment for cyclists. When I am the other way, I'm a demand side guy. Like, let's have so many cyclists out there that there's a mandate to make for better engineering, make for better, not just legislation, laws that cops A, even understand, and B, they enforce. Because as it is now, every one of your listeners can tell you, the moment you go to a cop and say, hey, so-and-so driver did whatever, you you either get, well, what the hell were you doing on a bike to begin with?
Right.
Or you get the response of, well, it was really just your word against you. That's
right.
Typically what you get from a cop. So, you know, there's a lot of things there. So I'm attacking this job if I can keep my head, if I can get over the machine gun fire of the bureaucracies and the incessant number of meetings that are scheduled. I wish to attack it from a marketing and communications angle, and we want to humanize what it is to be a cyclist. We want to really make sure that people understand this is in the interest of every Massachusetts city and town, especially when you look at Massachusetts collectively is the largest college town in the world, taking good care of cyclists. And if you read anything, Diane, if any of your readers, read what's in the Washington Post this week about millennials aren't driving anymore.
That is true. We talk about that all the time. They don't want a car.
They don't want a car. And where do they want to go? They want to go into cities and have bike share, bike facilities. They want to walk. They want transit. They want things. Well, guess what? Newsflash. Atlanta, Charlotte, Dallas, these cities are just in trouble now because they can't attract talented young people.
Cleveland is right there with that. We have that we call it the brain drain, and it is a real problem.
What they did was they took urban renewal funds and they made evacuation plans for a 5 o'clock white executive evacuation plan.
Right.
And so they all left. And the make of a great city, large or small, is whether or not people live in it.
It's interesting. As someone who is not an urban planner, and as someone who is not an attorney or a legislator, that you grasp that as well as anybody I've ever spoken with.
Well, thanks.
So this is a full-time position. What's going to happen with some of your race announcing and your, you know, your World Cup event and some of the other things you do? You're not going to stop your gravel grinder stuff. You're going to do all that stuff still, yes?
Well, as I said, it was kind of interesting. I was in the interview process, I said, you know, if I'm going to be at a cycling event, I might as well be the guy with the microphone. So regional cycling events, I'll continue to announce. I probably will have to give up some of my national events. I intend to stay on as the cyclocross world championship announcer. It's a good time of year. And I get vacation time, too. I might as well go to Europe for it. And then I also, they were unable to make my salary, you know, the salary requirement I was looking for. So they were like, well, why don't you can stay working on Providence. And Providence, for any race organizer out there, we have it organized as a LLC where I'm a majority owner. But my other staffers are taking on more and more and more responsibility. So Providence is built to grow. We have a big team. It's not just me. Most cycling events you go to have one person. Most of my important work for Providence is done in sponsorship sales. And that's pretty done. We're in a good position there.
Do you live in Boston?
Nope, I live in Lexington.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Just to remind people, we are still talking with Richard Freese, and it's always so fascinating to talk with you. Could we talk a little bit about the safety of cyclists? Because I know that has to be on your agenda. It's not just that people recognize that they're out there, but for example, what happened in Baltimore to Tom Palermo?
Okay.
Where the bishop ran him over, and now she has been charged. So she has been charged with 7 or 8 counts of everything from manslaughter to driving under the influence. Can you affect that kind of change, do you think, with your organization?
Yeah, I woke up the other day having had way too many beers in Austin, Texas. And David Watson, my predecessor, who is still here, and he's like, hey, today's the deadline for us to file legislation. I was like, it's 7:30 in the morning. And I'm like, what? He had it covered. This guy totally had it covered. But, you know, it's one of the things, and this is really interesting. And here's where I may incite some riots. Bike advocacy, we need to always, always, always be working at the table in those planning meetings. And we've worked hard to get to that table, to where we are even considered in road design. And we need to stay there. We need to really push there. And we need to, you know, box out our position and hold on. And fight like hell to make the safest conditions for cyclists, and in an engineering way, and in a enforcement way, and in a legislative way. That said, and this is where my predecessor David Watson is entirely brilliant. One of my first jobs in here is to eliminate the word safety from our dialogue entirely.
What are you going to substitute it with?
Well, the issue is that the number one thing you can get to make your bike ride safer is not a helmet, it's not light, it's not reflective stuff, it's not a horn, a whistle, a bell, body armor. It's another cyclist. More cyclists makes it safer for more cyclists, and more cyclists makes it safer for automobiles, and more cyclists makes it safer for pedestrians, and that's been shown in every study. What I wish to do is, instead of replacing it, really replace it with words like, you know, let's talk about cycling confidence, let's talk about cycling competence, cycling skills. But and let me tell you a story of Robert McNamara. Robert McNamara, many people know of him as the architect of our failed policy as Secretary of Defense under the Kennedy administration in the Vietnam War. Well, he had another failure before that. He was the president and CEO, I believe his title was, of Ford. And he came in with deplorable safety statistics for automobiles. And he launched a safety campaign to make sure that Ford had the safest cars on the highway. He did all sorts of things, that just made cars safer. And he touted those in their advertising and their communication. Well, they fired him, and when they fired him, or around the time they wanted to fire him, it was one of the Ford family actually said, you know, McNamara is selling safety, but Chevrolet is selling cars. Their sales went in the toilet, Diane. And it's like when you start to tout safety, people say, well, their car's not, it must be dangerous to drive their cars.
Right.
So the point being is that Chevrolet show beautiful women, convertibles, and I'm not saying we don't work for safety. What I'm saying is we encourage people to do things. And, for example, I have a big problem here that the Mass Medical Society, the doctor's lobby, is about to launch legislation in my state mandating helmet usage for all cyclists at all times. I'm about to ride home. I'm putting my helmet on. I'm putting my lights on. I have 6 lighting systems on my bike. I have reflective stuff on.
Yeah, but you don't want that mandated necessarily.
Well, the problem is that every study that they've ever done on it said whenever there's a helmet mandate, cycling usage and cycling participation goes down.
That's correct. It drops. That is correct.
It drops, thereby making cycling more dangerous. Does that make
right.
sense?
Of course it does.
You become the asterisk on the highway
right.
instead of part of the flow because your numbers go down. This is why Copenhagen, you feel so safe when you ride a bike in Copenhagen or Amsterdam or Germany or, you know, all over. Point being, how would you argue your statement on this? Because they're going to come to me in a few weeks and ask me for, we will have to have an official position.
Well, I think there are statistics that you can each, of course, their official position would be, we don't want that many cyclists on the road. I mean, that they'll come back to you and say, yeah, that's okay with us. We don't care how many cyclists are really riding. You're not going to be able to argue that position by saying, by mandating helmets, they're going to be less cyclists. I think you have to come at it perhaps from a different perspective, and maybe it's one that says we want to clean up the streets from too many cars, too many accidents, too many everything else, and what we want to do is educate. I would like legislation that says let's educate motorists with their driver's licenses. Children who are getting driving education get bicycle education, you know, and you start that in grade school. You don't start that in high school. And just, you know, begin adding different kinds of legislation. I don't know. I believe that it's got to be education, that as cyclists, if they really want to be on the road, they're going to have to step up and say, we'll ride together. Like you said, every morning, maybe everybody starts at a certain place and you know, people start just more cyclists on the road. But helmets? Ridiculous. As my partner says, my helmet is for my mirror. I would ride without one if it wasn't for my helmet mirror.
Well, it's, you know, by the time you're using a helmet, it's pretty late in the equation if you're using it. My response is MassBike will support this legislation with one caveat, that you also mandate helmet usage for every motorist inside a car.
That's awesome.
And when they say, well, that's ridiculous, I go, well, why do you think it's ridiculous? How did you get brainwashed into believing it's ridiculous? 40,000 people die in car crashes.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So the question is, why do we think that's ridiculous?
How many members are there of MassBike?
Not enough. 2,500. by comparison, San Francisco has 13,000.
Yeah, no, you're right. That's not enough. You are absolutely right.
And that's where I'm going, and that's where I'm going with everything. I mean, up on my wall here is a big thing that says it's about membership.
It is about membership. That is exactly right. It's getting more people not only to sign up, but to actually ride their bikes on the street.
Well, and here's where I'm going to get, you know, people may say some things. We've done a really good job of getting the urban advocate to join, and it's great. But I just went through the membership list, and I just started firing names of these people. And it's these people that have somehow been accused of being narcissistic or whatever. You know, they call them the mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra. And we're like, well, we have to go after, we got to go after ordinary people. That's what I hear all the time. And we can't go after those people. Those people are no good.
Those people have money and they have influence.
Yeah, go tell me bike shop. You're not going to go after middle-aged men with Lycra.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And they'll show you the door. So I'm going to grab the low-hanging fruit. I'm looking for people in our affluent suburbs that I know are cyclists, and I'm going to just start dialing for dollars. All I need you to do is join. And all I need you to do is join and ask your friends to join.
You know what? That's the way all the big organizations do it. People like Rails to Trails, they go after the money and after the influence and after the people who want to be able to ride their bikes without being hassled.
Right.
Too many cycling deaths. I'm sorry. Just too many.
Well, one thing we have to remember is that there is, and this is one thing I will always tell, and this comes up all the time in the advocacy world, and I will say this over and over and over, there is no such thing as a correct cyclist, and every cyclist is a work in progress. Every one of us, even myself.
All right. Well, I guess on that note, since we've been talking for a half hour, we're going to do this again. I want to hear how it goes with this helmet legislation. I really wish you a lot of luck with your new position. You are going to be great. You are going to be great.
We'll see.
All right.
It's hard.
Have a great night. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Diane. Diane, you do a great job, and your listeners are blessed to have somebody who works as hard as you do.
Oh, thank you. All right. You take care, Mr. Richard Fries.
All right.
Bye-bye.
See you, Diane. Bye-bye.
Richard Fries joined me from his office as the new executive director of Mass Bike. I just love talking to him.
What's always great is when he comes up with a phrase, people may say something,
right.
But he says it anyways, and he needs to say it, and people need to hear it, and people need to do something about it.
25 candidates, most better qualified in terms of the criteria, and guess who they chose? They chose the one who's going to make the difference. We are going to take a break on the Outspoken Cyclist, and we'll be back with some news. And then we're going to head on over to Portland and talk with Ellie Blue. You are listening to the Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of the Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back on the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
We have some news.
In tech, Nikola pedals. They have this new design that comes out where the pedal itself has 25 millimeters of lateral motion. And by lateral motion, that means it sort of slides in and out.
It is not like put an extender on there and it's a fixed extension.
Nope. It's not a fixed extension.
Huh.
It's actually the pedal itself. Your foot will move out and it will move back in. And if I found the information at their website, NikolaInnovation.com. They have video. They have some studies that they've done.
That was my question. Is there something visual you can go look at?
There is. And I like the concept. They said it's similar to a speed skater. In that,
oh, who's doing skating.
But it's only 25 millimeters each one, so you're not talking.
25 millimeters is 2.5 centimeters. That's
right.
A lot.
So, I found that to be really interesting to start the year with.
Okay. All right. We'll see. Is it prototypical or is it for sale?
Not for sale yet.
Okay. Do you want to go ride with Bernardino?
Yes, of course. Absolutely.
Well, do I have your attention? I guess I do. Louis Garneau announced this week that Bernardino would be attending and riding the Quebec Grand Fondo. The Grand Fondo Garneau Quebecois is an annual 110-kilometer bike ride between Trois-Rivières and Saint-Augustin-de-Desmaures, and is now in its seventh year of existence. The goal of the event is to promote physical activity and healthy lifestyle while raising funds for the Little Brothers Foundation. The event is intended as much for the cycling enthusiast as for experienced cyclists. Last year, the event attracted close to 3,000 riders. The seventh edition will take place on Sunday, August 9th. It'll start at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Riders will leave Trois-Rivières at the Alphonse Desjardins Sports Center starting point and will arrive at the Louis Garneau Sports Factory finish line in the afternoon. Several groups will be formed according to cyclists' average riding speeds. Since its creation in 2009, the Grand Fondo has been very much involved in community to support charities dedicated to the well-being of the elderly. In 6 years, over $290,000 have been donated to the Little Brothers organization. So, in addition to riding with Bernardino, you, if you are one of the first 1,500 riders to sign up for the event, could be eligible to win the bike that Bernardino will be riding, a Garneau Genix Dura Ace. The bike is worth around $7,000. So it is QuebecGrandFondo.com.
I guess I better sign up pretty quick.
You better do it fast. And it's not even that expensive.
You know how much I love Twitter. The ASO made a surprise announcement via Twitter, simply listing 22 teams that were confirmed to be in the Tour de France.
Yeah, see, this is the I'm too lazy to write a real press release, you know, school of thought these days.
Let's just go ahead and put it out there and, you know, they'll get it. They'll understand.
All right.
Most exciting of all of the announcements was the Johannesburg-based MTM Quebeca was one of the five wildcard teams to participate in the 102nd edition of cycling's top race. I've been waiting my whole life for this news, Douglas Ryder, MTM Quebeca team principal, said in a statement on the team's website. We'll not only ride in the Tour, we'll compete, and we will have the support of the whole continent behind us.
Well, and, you know, I have to give a big shout out to Kim and Jacques over in Rwanda for the unbelievable work they've done to get the African teams up to par. MTN Quebeca is not one of their teams necessarily, but they have just done so much great work over there. I'm really excited that an African team, I don't remember who told us, but somebody said, maybe it was Paul Sherwin.
Yes, it was.
It was, who said, watch and see. There will be an African rider on the podium in the not-too-distant future. Very cool. Retired pro cyclist Christian Vandevelde listed his LeMont house for $950,000. He paid $1.1 million for it and remodeled it. And then, you know, he's going to take a beating. He retired from pro cycling in 2013, a year after he admitted to using blood doping products. He bought the house in 2009. It was built in 2008. It has 4.5 baths, an open floor plan, hardwood floors, a loft area, a kitchen with granite countertops and a large island, and a finished walkout lower level with recreation areas, a fireplace, and an additional bedroom or office. A large barn also sits on the 6-acre property. Sounds like the perfect house for me, only about 4 times too big.
Right. And it sounds like a lot of the other ones that are out there. So
Yeah. And I don't really know where LeMont is. Okay. Go ahead.
We always like to report on bike share projects that are actually working, but in this case, it's one that apparently didn't work.
Yeah.
And this comes from the voiceofoc.org, and that's OC as in Orange County. The Orange County Transportation Authority Monday canceled the pilot bike share program in Fullerton after an analysis showed taxpayers were subsidizing the project to the tune of nearly $800 per bicycle ride.
Per ride?
Per ride.
$800? You could buy two nice little hybrids for that.
You could just give them away and let people ride.
Exactly.
The authority board voted unanimously to cancel the program, which was supposed to enhance first and last mile connections to the city train station. Before the vote, directors and staff described the program's many shortcomings, which included stations that didn't work, clunky bicycles, lack of large employers in Fullerton to provide the riders for the system. As a result, total checkouts averaged only 86 trips per month, or 1.2 per bicycle. Now, there's a lot more to this article, and it talks about all of the things that went wrong with this, and maybe they shouldn't have started the program when they should have.
Right.
But this gets back to a conversation we had last year should this have been something maybe started by a private organization instead of the city?
There are the two schools of thought as to whether or not bike share should be publicly funded or privately funded. The Cleveland Bike Share Program is privately funded, but that ended up sort of usurping or jumping ahead on what was planned for Cleveland. So, I'll tell you, it's a crapshoot. Who knows?
And in a case like this, obviously, the city's not – it's going to have to be a long time down the road until they jump on board again to do something
like this. Yeah, my guess is like never.
Right.
All right, worst story of the week comes out of ABC News Channel 7 in San Francisco, San Jose, and Oakland. Cyclist hit in West Oakland. Bad enough, right? Robbed while unconscious.
Unconscious and okay.
It gets worse. A cyclist was seriously hurt after being hit by a truck on Tuesday morning, was lying unconscious in the street. However, the story gets worse from there. What 25-year-old Gregory Lowry needed was help. Instead, some witnesses did the unthinkable and robbed him. The impact knocked the cyclist some 50 feet from where he collided with a pickup truck. It happened around 11:30 a.m. at the corner of 8th and Union Streets in West Oakland. We were supposed to meet up. We were going to the food bank after he goes down to the clinic, Margaret Lowry, the victim's mother, said. Margaret says her son was riding his bike to the health clinic where he has been undergoing treatment for a serious heart condition. A witness heard the crash and ran outside. Witness Suga Slim said, "It was horrible, and I mean he never moved after that. The man never moved." But the story gets worse. While the 81-year-old driver of the truck was trying to help Gregory, a group of people went through his truck and stole his wallet. What is wrong with people?
You said Oakland, right?
West Oakland.
Okay.
And while the Gregory was lying on the ground by his bike, badly injured, police say a second group of people came up to him and took his wallet. "This is a wonderful neighborhood, but there's some lousy people here," his mother said. It is just sad. It's the worst story of the week. I just find it unbelievable that people would not only not help somebody, but they'd add insult to injury by robbing them. I mean, what are they thinking?
Well, my next one will be a positive. College cycling gate signs with King Cycling, and that's King College. And the reason that I talk about this is from Bristol, Tennessee. So many times we see football players, basketball players, and other athletes that are talked about signing and where they're going to go to college. This is actually one that they wrote in the local newspaper in Bristol about Victoria Gates, who's going to join the Tornadoes for the 2015 and 16 season.
Okay.
And I think it's great to see positive about cycling.
Everything positive about cycling is great, I think, for the most part.
Yes, and if you want to see more information on that, that's WJHL.com.
Very good. Okay, so this one cracked me up. This is my last one. It's the not-so-funny-but-you-gotta-laugh story, right? This is from cyclingweekly.co.uk. I'm sorry, it makes me laugh. It's written by Stuart Clark. What is something annoying that a cyclist might do? Okay, so that's the headline, right? Australian broadcast network 10 sparked backlash on Tuesday when its game show Family Feud asked contestants to name something annoying that a cyclist might do. So this is the show that's like Family Feud here, mm-hmm. right? Okay, they have it called Family Fortunes. They asked the question to 100 people, with the most popular answers being taking the driving lane and cutting you off. And then the third answer, which, by the way, had nobody who said that they had asked that question, was everything. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, response on social media suggested that Channel 10 was encouraging hatred of vulnerable road users. So I actually took a screenshot of the Family Feud board. Taking the driving lane. Remember, it was 100 people who were asked, right? So whatever the number is, it's a percentage. Taking the driving lane, 32. That's what they didn't like about cyclists, that they took the lane. Cutting you off, 18. Obviously, one of the contestants said everything. That got nothing. Run the red light got 8. Pull out in front got 6. Ride slowly got 5. Ring the bell, 4. And wear Lycra got 3.
So they just don't like Lycra.
That, to me, is pretty funny. Pretty funny. So that's my last story. You got one more?
Well, I do have one thing. I rolled through the Twitter stream, and this is, our friends over at Scratch Labs.
Yeah, of course. Bijou and Alan.
Yep. Well, guess what? It's wintertime. It's kind of cold. So what more would you possibly want for a cyclist in this time would be cookie mix. Scratch Labs has come out with a cookie mix that you can buy now.
Yum, yum.
And I saw the information from the thefeed.com blog, and the cookies actually look pretty good, and I think this is one of those that I should probably test for a later show.
You know, Bijou's shop, the Little Curry Shop, is just getting rave reviews in Denver. Just getting rave reviews. If I was in Denver, I'd be there. I'm not a huge curry fan, but I'm sure his stuff is wonderful. We're just going to take a real quick break, and then we're going to head right on over to Portland and speak with Ellie Blue about her new project. Hi, Ellie. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Happy New Year.
Hi, Diane. Happy New Year. Thanks so much for having me back.
It is my pleasure. We haven't spoken in a while, and I really want to talk to you about some of the new things that you're doing. We actually, when I ended the show last week and I said we were going to be talking with Ellie Blue, somebody posted to our Facebook page, oh, I can't wait to hear that interview. So,
well, hello, person on Facebook.
Right, exactly. So you are, if not the most, one of the most prolific female journalists in the bicycle world. You have such interesting projects, and you have a brand new one, the merging of your publishing company with Microcosm Publishing. Tell us about the two organizations and, you know, how they're compatible and how they're different and what prompted the actual merging of the two.
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. So I started as a side project about 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, Ellie Blue Publishing, which is I started just putting out zines, and then I've been starting to put out a few books. And my main mentor, really, who kind of helped me learn how to do this, and, you know, I, like, took a lot of strides on my own as well, was Joe Beal of Microcosm Publishing. And so he's been publishing books for 19 years. He actually started the company in his bedroom closet in Cleveland in 1996. So it's local to your listeners. And since has moved it out here to Portland, and there's has published about 300 books total. And I've put out three or four books and a bunch of zines, and I have three or four more books on the way each year. And so it made sense to us at some point just to combine our efforts, because, especially because as I was growing, I was having to start duplicating a lot of the infrastructure that Microcosm has already established. So it just made a lot of sense on a lot of levels to merge. We're basically the same as Penguin and Random House, just on a much tinier scale.
Let's talk about the size of the organization. You were sort of a one-man band, although I remember you had a few other people that, well, obviously you have other authors, but you pretty much handled Ellie Blue Publishing, or taking the lane, as some people know it, all by yourself. So how big is Microcosm now with you?
I am the 11th staff person.
Wow.
It's tiny by publishing standards, like absolutely minuscule, but it's huge by my standards. So I bring my talents and I bring my list, and it adds materially to what they're already doing, but it doesn't overwhelm them. And it's a kind of small extra thing to take on.
What will it be able to do that it couldn't do before having you there?
Well, one part of our merger is I'm still managing all my titles, so I'll still be publishing feminist books about bicycling. That's my thing that I love to do. I've got feminist science fiction about bicycling. I've got books about how to do things like yoga and cooking from a bicycling perspective. I've got a line of children's books coming out. But Microcosm has a whole bunch of different books, and our combined catalog is over 300 different books. And I'm one of the roles that I'm taking on is marketing manager for Microcosm. And this is something that really no one's been doing for quite some time, or hasn't been doing very much. So I have a kind of a big task on my plate of sort of like sorting through all of our different titles and figuring out the best ways to put them in front of the readers who will be most excited about them. And it's really, really fun.
You know, I was looking through Microcosm's site, and then I went back to your announcement of the merging, and I saw a title called Subbing. It was very interesting to me, and even though it doesn't have anything to do with cycling, tell us about Subbing.
So On Subbing is one of Microcosm's earliest published titles. I think it came out in 2004 or 2005 in terms of like being published as a real book with a spine. It's written by this guy named Dave Roach, who is working as a substitute teacher in Portland's education system, elementary education system. And he just writes just his everyday stories of like what happens with the kids, what happens in his life trying to live on a substitute teacher's salary. And he does ride his bike to the school, by the way.
Oh, so there is a cycling connection.
There is. And I mean, honestly, a lot of Microcosm's titles, and that is one of my favorite ones. Like, I just love the way it's written, and it's so both tragic and hilarious, and it kind of shows this social critique without being heavy-handed about it. But a lot of our titles are sort of in a similar vein. They're either about how to do things, like how to screen print your own T-shirts. We have our most popular book is called Make Your Place. It's about how to make sustainable housekeeping products. We have books about how to garden, how to build things in your backyard. And we also have books that are sort of like more about people's lives and about people sort of grappling to live their values in an adverse situation. And not all of it is about bicycling per se, though Microcosm has been publishing books about bicycling since before it was cool. But they are about sort of, I think, the values that a lot of people bring to cycling. Like, how do you like live in this world in a way that has meaning and has a positive impact, but that also feels good and is fun? And I think all of those things together, that's what bicycling is about for me, but a lot of other things are about that as well.
I am speaking with Ellie Blue out in Portland, Oregon. We are talking about her company's merging with Microcosm Publishing and what that's going to allow her to do in terms of expanding her work. What kinds of projects are you looking to produce in 2015? So as marketing manager, you don't just do, you know, normal marketing. You do lots of cool things. So what kind of projects are you going to be doing? Do you have any that you can share?
Well, I'm trying to dream up some publicity stunts for all our projects. So if anyone has ideas for that, please get in touch with me. Our website is microcosmpublishing.com, and my email address is on our contact page. But some of the books that I'm working on right now, it's a really cool array. There's a book about sprouting food. There's a book about birth. It's called Taking Back Birth. And it's sort of an alternative child-bearing and birthing guide. And we also have some bicycle books on the lineup. So there's one called Urban Revolutions, and Microcosm was actually working on this before I came on board. It's just a happy coincidence, but it's a city planner wrote it, and she's a Southern woman, and it's a guide kind of geared towards women who are concerned about getting on bikes and kind of giving them the basics they need to go ahead and get on a bicycle and have fun doing it. So I'm really excited about all of the books, honestly.
When you talk about marketing ideas, or are you talking about events or actually just different ways of, you know, social media? What kind of things are you thinking about?
Kind of all of the above. So I think marketing means different things in different industries. In publishing, it's a lot about managing data about each book and coordinating between all of the different people who are involved in creating a book and bringing it to market. So I start talking with authors when they just have an idea, like before they even, like once they've signed a contract, but before they even start writing. And I figure out like how the book needs to be described and whether or not the book has an audience, and how, if it does, then how to reach that audience. So, and then as the book sort of progresses, I start thinking about creative ways to sell it and events that we could have. And I work with the author on their tour, and I'm still doing the Dinner and Bikes tour.
Well, that was going to be my next question about your travel plans for this year.
I've jumped the gun. I have a lot of travel plans for this year, actually.
But they would probably include some of these marketing ideas, perhaps, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the, you know, I had a huge tour schedule set up for this year before the merger. So one of the kind of things that I'm thinking about is how to include more of our authors in these events that we're doing all over the country. So I'm going to be trying to meet up with, you know, people who live in Texas, people who live in Illinois, see if we can kind of make our traveling roadshow even more interesting and dynamic.
Yeah, because the dinner and it was dinner and a presentation. I think it was at the Old Stone Church, wasn't it?
Here
it
was.
In Cleveland.
Oh,
yeah,
it was a really fun event.
And it's a beautiful facility. If anybody wants to come to Cleveland and see it before they rip up Public Square to change it for the Republican National Convention, they're not going to destroy the church by any means. I just don't know what the access is going to be. Are you going to travel with Joe again this year? Are you going to be doing Dinner and Bikes again?
We are. So Joe and Joshua Plug, who's our chef, and he's also one of our most prolific cookbook authors. He has a new cookbook called This Ain't No Picnic, Your Punk Rock Vegan Cookbook. And it's a full-color cookbook of punk song themed recipes, and it's really quite amazing. And he got like all these like famous people in the punk world to write introductions for each section. It's a good book. So we're going to be taking that and our talk about bikes and our movies about bikes on the road, and we'll be going from Texas to Nebraska and back again, and kind of hitting the whole middle of the country that we've missed in our last few tours.
So do you ever have time to just sit around and chill out?
That's a good question. I do more now, actually. I mean, the merger is only about a month old, so that's hard to say, but it's really like, instead of like worrying about all of the little things that I was managing before, like not just like, how will I get this book to print, but like, how will I advance the feminist bicycle revolution? Now it's like my job is much more clearly defined. My work has better boundaries. I can work really, really hard during the week and then relax on the weekend. So that's been really nice. So that's a benefit. And now I have a bike commute. That's the other big change. I was a bike rider for years without a bike commute, I confess.
Wow. Okay. That's a big confession. And you heard it here.
Yeah, days would go by without me getting on a bike.
I know that feeling, you know, owning a bike shop. People said, oh, you own a bike shop, you must get to ride. Yeah, right. We never get to ride because during the bike season, we're working, you know.
Exactly.
So talking about bikes, speaking of bikes, what's your newest, most favorite bike right now?
Oh, let's see. Well, probably the one that has come most recently into my life. I don't know if I had it last time I talked to you or not, but I got a Brompton folding bike.
Oh, Brompton's a big deal right now.
Mm-hmm. Joe and I both got them so that we could take them on the train because we ride Amtrak to most of our events all over the country. So, and Amtrak has like really difficult bike policies, but folding bikes is a little bit easier. We actually got them to change their bike policy because we had some drama on the train with our bikes about a year ago.
You know, Patrick Brady just had an issue on a train, and I think it was Bart out in San Francisco. I think his bike was stolen.
Oh, no, that's terrible.
I think that's what I remember. Somebody, you know, they gave him a really, really hard time about bringing it on board, and then he had to get away from it and go sit where he's supposed to sit. And when he went back, the bike wasn't there. So,
oh, that's terrible.
I know. So, if you can get any trains to be more respectful of bikes, that is an awesome thing. Well, anything you want to wrap up before you get back to work? I'm going to make you go back to work because you're 3 hours behind us.
I guess I do need to go back to work. I just want to give a shout out to all of the bike people in northeastern Ohio, and especially to our friends at Joy Machines Bike Shop. I love what they're doing, and I feel like they're really pushing the revolution forward. So good work, you all.
Well, I'm sure they will appreciate it, and all our listeners everywhere will appreciate it. Ellie, thank you so much for talking with me. Good luck with your new projects. And if you get back to Ohio, you know where we are.
Awesome. I can't wait to visit again. Thanks so much, Diane.
You're welcome. Have a good evening.
You as well. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Ellie Blue joined me from the offices of Microcosm Publishing.
She's not busy at all, is she?
I'm telling you, I can't understand how she even keeps all these projects straight. There's so many of them.
And can you believe that we did a whole interview with somebody from Oregon and Ohio State, Oregon? Football game didn't even come up once.
Exactly, because my guess is Ellie would go, huh?
We're too busy to.
Exactly, to watch football. At any rate, I appreciate Ellie talking with me. She always has such interesting new projects. That's our show for this week. Thank you to Richard Fries. Thank you to Ellie Blue. And thanks for listening. Hope you have a chance to go for a ride. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.